Welcome to the California Sun Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Scheckman. The story of housing in America is a complex tapestry woven from threads of geography, culture, economics, and politics. For California, where the history of housing issues lacks the longevity of some East Coast cities, the issues are even more complex. It's a story that touches and shapes the very fabric of our cities, of the places we call home. My guest today, Max Podemski, has dedicated his career to understanding this intricate narrative. Max is an urban planner for the city of Los Angeles and a lifelong architecture enthusiast. His new book, A Paradise of Small Houses, Max takes us on a journey through the history of America's most iconic housing styles, from the Philadelphia row house to the Chicago workers' cottage, and reveals the profound impact that they've had on urban landscapes and perhaps what we in California can learn from the experience. Max tells a story about the lessons embedded in these traditional housing types that may hold the key to solving America's and California's current housing crisis. By understanding how previous generations built affordable, livable neighborhoods, he argues we can adapt their wisdom to create more equitable and sustainable cities for the 21st century. Max's work sits at the intersection of urban planning, social history, and design, offering a fresh perspective on one of the most pressing issues of our time. His voice is a vital addition to the national conversation about housing, and it is my pleasure to welcome Max Podemski here to the California Sun Podcast. Max, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. When we think about housing and we think about it in the context of the history of housing, particularly urban housing, do we find that it is often housing that has shaped lifestyles in particular cities, or the lifestyles have shaped the housing?
Well, I think it's really both. I mean, I think if we're talking about the history of housing in this country, you know, we're going back to colonial times when technology was very different. So a lot of housing in America comes out of constraints and usually transportation. So if we're talking about colonial Philadelphia or Boston, the way people got around was on foot. So by necessity, cities really had to be dense and cramped and conform to very small lot sizes. But within that, we really have a huge diversity of housing styles that's still really apparent today. So it's sort of, you know, I would say people can conforming to constraints, but also within that, there's sort of a certain amount of cultural expression.
And as the country moved west, of course, a lot of that changed. The constraints changed. The rules changed in some ways.
Yeah. And so definitely a huge change. And by the time we get to California, when a lot of our major cities were developing in Southern California and Northern California, a whole range of options opening up in terms of transportation, which really sort of liberated housing styles and resulted in sort of this wonderful diversity of house types.
To what extent did those diversity of house types parallel changes that were taking place in zoning, or were there other factors that drove that diversity?
Well, I think if we're talking about a place like LA, which really is one of the fastest growing places in human history, going from, you know, a very tiny village to over a million people in about 40 years, LA sort of has this very different history than other cities. So if we're talking about New York or even San Francisco, really settled by immigrants coming from Europe and other places, you know, very low income and having to live in pretty dense conditions. LA, by contrast, was settled mostly by native-born Americans. And they were people, you know, usually escaping the Midwest or colder climates and coming here to almost reinvent themselves. And housing really became a part of that. So you're talking about, you know, housing as an expression of lifestyle. You know, in Southern California, that's sort of the ultimate, one of the ultimate examples of that. And, you know, going down sort of an older street in the city, we see a huge variety of housing types, sort of a, you know, building that looks like a French chateau next to a Spanish style house, next to an arts and crafts house. And all of that really predates zoning. But by the 20s, you know, zoning and different regulations come in and really sort of change how housing styles look.
Talk about that a little bit, how it changed it and really how it impacted the evolution of housing in a place like Southern California, first of all.
Sure. So stepping back a little bit, one of the main theses of the book is that urban housing in the United States is really sort of one of our main innovations as a country. You know, we like to think of buildings as like the tenements or these small apartments as sort of being inflicted on poor immigrants by unscrupulous landlords. But in a lot of places, they were built by and for immigrants. And they expressed their cultural values. They gave them affordable housing to live in the middle of the city. And they also, in many cases, were sort of ways into the mainstream of society and sort of let people ascend economically and become homeowners. But there's this battle. So you have, you know, cities which are, especially at the turn of the century, almost overwhelmingly composed of immigrants and their children. And most of these immigrants were, you know, Catholics, Jews, people from Eastern Europe, people from Southern Europe, and people really from all over the globe. But the elite of the country at that time was really composed of upper class native born Protestants. And to them, you know, America was really this city of single family homes on their own lot. You had a garden. That was sort of the ideal of the country. And it was, you know, almost goes back to the founding fathers with, you know, Thomas Jefferson saying all Americans should be farmers, except for, you know, carpenters and smiths, which farmers needed. So there's really this battle playing out between upper class reformers and immigrants over what America should look like. And so zoning was sort of a triumph of these reformers. And it was a way to bring order to the city and, you know, preclude sort of some of these denser housing types. But in California, I would like to say, you know, today we have California, which is, you know, one of the most expensive housing markets in the country. And a lot of that has been attributed to, you know, things like zoning, things that to prevent housing from being built. But the zoning really played out differently in California. In Los Angeles, you know, a lot of these denser housing types were really celebrated. And they had access to air and light. And really, it was sort of an accumulation of these regulations over time that prevented a lot of traditional housing styles from being built.
One of the things that's so interesting, looking at the East Coast, for example, is the different types of housing that grew up that you talk about in the book, things like the workers' cottages in Chicago and the row houses in Philadelphia. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the row house is really sort of the first real example of urban housing in the country. You know, Philadelphia was the city's the country's largest city and its main port in the 17th and 18th century. And sort of the ideas of England sort of flow into the country through Philadelphia. And so, you know, Philadelphia back in the 1600s, you had log cabins, you had houses literally dug into caves in the Delaware River banks. And the row house came in and it basically was a new urban housing type that conformed to dense urban lots. So, you know, lots as narrow as 12 feet, but allowed people to have their own freestanding house. And so that concept sort of spreads up and down the East Coast, and you see a huge variety of row houses. So if you go to Baltimore, you sort of have these row houses made of this deep red brick, and they're adorned with, you know, ivory stoops and white cornices and sort of window frames. And if you go 40 miles to the south to Washington, D.C., you also have row houses, but a very different type. You know, you sometimes have turrets. They'll usually be made out of brick that's painted, you know, yellow, blue, different colors. And then going to New York City, you have brownstones, which is a type. So it's sort of the row house was sort of this original flourishing of urban housing that gets carried up and down the East Coast, but also sort of expresses these regional housing types in each city.
Given the proliferation of this diversity of East Coast housing, it's interesting that none of these styles really made their way with any kind of consistency to the West Coast, to California.
Well, I would say San Francisco is really the exception to that. So a lot of those styles really date from the 1800s. And San Francisco was really one of the, few large cities that developed in the West in the 1800s. So, and it really has to do with lot size. So usually a row houses on a 25-foot wide lot are narrower. And San Francisco is really the only city in the West Coast where that narrow lot size is widespread. But the interesting thing about San Francisco is, as soon as you leave, the 48 square miles of San Francisco, you're sort of back in traditional Western California style neighborhoods with, bungalows on 50-foot lots.
But even San Francisco, as it evolved, there was more and more movement towards single-family housing, even within the city.
You definitely have the single family housing, definitely as you get more into the Western neighborhoods, the Sunset and the Richmond, but it still usually conforms to that 25-foot lot where you have that shared party wall. Whereas the standard lot size in LA and, Portland and Seattle, lots of other West Coast city is 50-foot lots. So they're actually totally surrounded by yard space. And so the 50-foot lot really comes into use at the beginning of the 20th century. And that really comes into use with the bungalow, which is housing type that originates in England, but was really pioneered in California and still sort of predominates in lots of our neighborhoods here in California from the early 20th century. But it was also really a huge technological leap. So if we're looking at sort of older building styles like the row house or the worker's cottage, they have these very geometric floor plans where it's basically a series of rooms. So, one or two rooms on each floor. And traditionally, those rooms would be used for all different sorts of activities. So you would sleep in one, you would cook in one. Bathrooms and kitchens were usually in separate buildings or in the basement. The bungalow is sort of really the first modern house because it creates, rooms for specified uses. So you would have a bedroom, you would have a dining room, you would have a living room, you would have a kitchen inside the house and a bathroom inside the house. And they would sort of express these new technological innovations in plumbing and also having appliances. And sort of with that new house, you also get a new lot. So instead of those being on really dense lots, they come on those 50 by 100 square foot lots. And that's really how most of the, West Coast develops, because a lot of the cities had their main, periods of growth in the early 20th century.
One of the things that you talk about is that we can learn a lot in terms of dealing with some of the housing crisis we see today by looking at these traditional kinds of housing, particularly that grew up on the East Coast.
I mean, one great example is Philadelphia. During the turn of the century, Philadelphia was one of the largest cities on the planet. It was called the workshop of the world because it had so many factories there, and was really a working class city of immigrants. But one thing that really distinguished Philadelphia from other cities in the world is it was a place where a working class family could purchase their own row house and become a homeowner. And so the row house was sort of seen as this incredible innovation. And it was actually, there was a model of the row house at the World Columbia Exposition in Chicago, the famous, White City World's Fair there. And that's sort of something that's been lost. If we see new housing rising in our cities today, it's often advertised as luxury housing. The rents are incredibly high. But if we're going back to, a few generations ago in the United States, it was sort of the opposite, where the majority of housing built in our large city was really for working class people. They allowed them to live in the heart of the city, near their jobs, near resources, and really create these fantastic communities that people still love today. And, oftentimes a lot of these working class neighborhoods are now being gentrified. And a house that once, was occupied by a factory worker is now occupied by, a banker or a tech executive.
One of the things that we see, and this is, I think, true on both coasts, it's certainly true in California, is we see a cyclical nature to housing, that there's a period of time people want large houses, then smaller, then larger. Talk about that.
Well, one really, you know, shocking statistic I found in the book is the average house size since the 70s has basically doubled to around 2,000 square feet today. And that's despite the fact that the average family size has gone down by one person. So there's really been this drive for a tremendous amount of space. And that's really, I think, in contrast to how, you know, cities function. Usually it's people living in smaller apartments. So, you know, one of the examples of the book, one of the chapters is on Houston. And Houston is a city with, you know, very lax building regulations. And you have entire neighborhoods that were once composed of little bungalows that have been developed with these very long, skinny houses that are about 2,500 square feet. So about, you know, 1,500 square feet larger than sort of a traditional bungalow here in California. But I think, you know, there's really some negative aspects to that. I think, you know, one of the things people love about cities is the sense of community, sort of being in public spaces, being in parks, being in cafes, being around other people. And this move to these larger housing units, especially in cities, is sort of, you know, taking away some of that street life and culture. So, for example, in Houston, instead of these houses opening up to the sidewalk, you know, with a porch or a front door, they're totally dominated by a garage door. The front door is actually hidden on the side of the house, and you can't even, you know, it takes you a while to even figure out how to enter it. And sort of that need for size is even, you know, manifesting itself in older cities. So in New York, on the Upper East Side, there's this huge trend of apartments being conjoined to make one enormous apartment. And because of that, you know, certain parts of Manhattan are actually losing population. And there's a similar trend in Chicago. There's these traditional three flat apartments. So three separate units that are being combined into one large mansion. And so basically there's a net loss of, you know, affordable housing in a lot of these cities due to people combining units to create you know, these large mansions in the middle of the city.
What are we getting wrong on the West Coast in San Francisco and in Los Angeles in terms of the conversations we have about needing to increase housing, increase density in particular? What are we missing from a historical perspective?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, in California, we tend to look at our state as a state of, you know, single family home, you know, sprawling neighborhoods, low density. And we see, you know, apartment buildings or higher density neighborhoods really to be antithetical to our way of life. But that, you know, really isn't the case. I mean, if you walk around basically any neighborhood in the state that's before World War II, you're going to find a variety of housing types. So I live here in Silver Lake in Los Angeles. You know, my neighbor is a duplex. On the other side, it's a fourplex. But, you know, these buildings have, you know, they're one or two stories. They're low slung. You would walk past them and not even know that they're multifamily housing. And that's the case in a lot of parts of the state. And it really blends in. And, you know, a lot of these communities that have this variety of housing are actually very coveted and sought after. If we're talking about, you know, neighborhoods in Berkeley or in San Francisco or in Santa Monica. And so I think we really need to change our attitude about density and not just see it as sort of large slab-like apartments, but that it can become in a lot of different styles and configurations that are actually historically have been part of our communities here in California.
How do we change it, not just in terms of attitude, but in terms of public policy?
Well, the state has been making a lot of changes in state law to allow more housing. I think one of the most, you know, prominent changes that your listeners might be familiar with is allowing accessory dwelling units or granny flats. So this is sort of allowing people to take their backyard and convert their garage into an apartment or build a new unit back there. So we have really been, you know, making reforms to allow more housing. I think one of the issues with a lot of these reforms is that they're still almost, you know, treat multifamily housing as it's something shameful and try to hide that it's multifamily housing. So an ADU law, for example, usually there's restrictions on the height. They have to be separated from the main house. There's sort of this thing that's supposed to be hidden. So if you're like driving down the street, it still looks like it's all single family homes. But as I mentioned before, you know, if you go to a lot of neighborhoods in Berkeley or Los Angeles that date before World War II, you know, you have fourplexes, you have sixplexes, you have bungalow courts, you have buildings that are unquestionably multifamily, but they still are at a low scale. They have open space and greenery. They blend into these neighborhoods. And people love those buildings. So I think instead of trying to hide housing, we should sort of embrace these new, these traditional forms of urban housing that, you know, we can find in a lot of our neighborhoods in California.
With respect to actually producing this kind of housing, are you finding that developers are behind the marketplace or are trying to get out ahead of the marketplace?
I think developers do really respond to the marketplace. But, you know, going back to sort of these large units, you know, a lot of things, what we'll see is developers building these very, even if they build sort of a fourplex, it'll sort of be these enormous white cubes that are in a lot of cases out of scale with how neighborhoods look. But I think that's a reflection of the fact that housing is just so expensive. And it's very difficult to build new housing. So when developers do build it, they're usually building for the top of the market. But I think if we make it easier to build, they might build to a more variety, wider variety of the market. And that might result in, you know, different housing styles being built.
And the other part of it is how long it takes to get these projects done in terms of approvals, et cetera, that the market sometimes changes during that process.
Yeah. So, you know, there's sort of so many different issues coming up. You know, with housing in the state, I think first is, you know, if you're a developer, you know, working in a large city in California, you have to find a piece of land where you can build on it. And so, you know, where the zoning allows it. And often because there's, you know, so few parcels, you know, those parcels will be extremely expensive. And then you have to go through the permitting process and you know, you might need a variance from the zoning, which takes a discretionary action. So you have to go to a zoning administrator or a planning commission to get that approved. And yeah, it can take sometimes, you know, 1 or 2 years to start building. And then, you know, another thing now is the lending market's very difficult to get financing for these units. So there's really a whole confluence of factors, you know, working against building housing.
What are you seeing and what are planners in general seeing as the most promising reforms potentially in California to address some of these issues?
Well, you know, one of sort of the marquee reforms is the Housing Element Program, which is a statewide program. This is actually something that's been happening for quite a while. And basically, the state creates targets for each metropolitan region in the state. So the Bay Area, LA, San Diego, Sacramento, of how much they need to build in each category for each decade. So, you know, you need to build X amount of middle income housing, X amount of low income housing, X amount of high income housing. And then that's apportioned to each city in the region. But historically, it's sort of almost been a joke with extremely low numbers. So, for example, the city of Beverly Hills here in LA, you know, in the past has had something like 3 units of affordable housing that they've had to build each decade. But the governor has really, where regions now have to build a very, you know, high number of housing. So I think here in Southern California or here in Los Angeles, it's over 500,000 units that need to be built. And so this is causing cities to have to rezone for new housing. And I think one of the positive aspects of this program is it gives cities liberty to decide where to put this housing in a way that makes sense for their community. I think that's one of the problems with a lot of the state laws we were talking about, is there's sort of this one size fits all approach to how, you know, new housing should go in that might not reflect, you know, the incredibly diverse neighborhoods in California. But this program sort of allows cities to decide where that housing needs to go. And then they create a plan But then that plan needs to be approved by the state. And one of the big problems is that a lot of cities are not turning in plans that are not compliant because they won't really result in any housing being built, or they're just refusing to turn in a plan at all.
And one of the things that we're seeing is plans that get turned in that even sometimes are positive and show where housing can be built, but the fact is it doesn't get done.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, you know, I think one of the other lessons of the book is that policymakers like myself, you know, we can design all these programs, these incentives, but at the end of the day, you know, the people that build housing are developers. So, you know, they're the ones who are building all these, bring all these homes to market. And, you know, there might be so many factors about why they're not able to do that.
And does a developer want to come into a community where there's resistance? I mean, things like the situation in Huntington Beach, where there's just no desire to really do it, even though a plan may have been submitted to the state.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, developers usually do not want to, you know, make people mad, make elected right. officials mad. You know, for a long time, you really needed these discretionary approvals, you know, from an elected official or a planning commission to get a project built. So they had to have sort of good relationships. Sometimes those relationships would become corrupt, which we've seen a lot of examples here in Los Angeles. But yeah, usually developers are not in the business of, you know, going to a community and upsetting everyone, because that would sort of compromise their future work in that community.
You've been doing this for a while. Are you seeing real changes in the way all of this is being approached today because the situation has gotten so dire?
Yeah, I think I've seen a big change from communities and elected officials being very suspicious of new housing to there being a broad acknowledgement that we do need new housing and working to create policies to build it. And I have seen a lot of positive changes. You know, here in Los Angeles, there was a program that was actually passed through a ballot measure. So voters voted to approve this that resulted in a community called the Transit Oriented Communities Program that essentially allowed developers to build larger buildings near transit, so near rail or near high frequency bus lines. And we've seen a huge, you know, explosion of apartment buildings being built on our commercial corridors in LA.
That's what the state was trying to do with things like SB 50.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, yeah. Scott Wiener tried to do a similar program statewide. I think one of the, you know, nuances in the TOC program here, and, you know, as I recall, that statewide program is in Los Angeles, it doesn't apply to R1 zones. So it doesn't apply to single family zones. It only applies to higher density zones. And I think that statewide program would have applied to all zones within a certain radius of transit.
And are you optimistic that this progress will continue, the progress that you're seeing?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think we do have to look outside the state to see some laws that have, I think, been really impactful. So in Oregon, where I grew up, which sort of has a long history of progressive urban planning policies, recently passed a program that allows a whole range of housing types on even single family zones. So everything from row homes to bungalow courts to four and six plexes. And this was actually in response to, you know, on the east side of Portland, which is a traditionally pretty middle and working class neighborhood that has become, you know, very expensive within the last several decades. You saw these small bungalows being ripped down for extremely large sort of McMansions. And this law basically, you know, does not allow new McMansions to be built. So I think homes over 1,200 square feet cannot be built in the city, but a range of housing types can. And I think that really illustrates one of the points I was making before, is that we could either have a building that's the exact same size and impact on the community, and it can either be a mansion for a very rich person, or it can be, you know, three to four homes. And that program, you know, has really been successful. And you'll walk down a street in all their neighborhood in Portland, and there'll be bungalows, but then there'll be, you know, a new townhome development. that creates sort of 4 to 6 homes on what was previously a single family lot. And it really also shows, you know, it has very little impact on the community and actually fits in very well. You know, they often have a porch in front, they have landscaping in front. And it's really sort of going back to what I was talking about before of how we traditionally built our neighborhoods in this country, where they weren't just, you know, one type of house endlessly repeated, but this huge variety of housing. That also allowed, you know, a variety of families to live in a neighborhood. So, you know, not just wealthy people, but, you know, a single mom who might need to rent an apartment and then can send their kid to the local school, or an older person who maybe doesn't want to live in a big house and wants a smaller unit, to, you know, people straight out of college who might have gotten a job in the city and, you know, need a place to live.
It really is a question of demographic change as much as anything else. We'll see how Gen Z and millennials really adapt to all of this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that has also been, you know, if we're talking about cultural change, you know, really since the 90s, we've seen a huge resurgence of urban areas. So they were losing population, in some cases really hemorrhaging population. I mean, even San Francisco lost people in the 70s and 80s to the 90s, where a lot of cities are larger than they've ever been. So New York, you know, has basically added the equivalent of Philadelphia to its population since the 90s. And so there's a real desire, especially amongst, you know, millennials and Gen Z, to live in dense urban areas where they can walk, where they can take public transit, where they, you know, live within close proximity to, you know, cafes and restaurants and shops. But, you know, because of a lot of these, you know, regulations, some of which that date back, you know, 100 years in the past, it's been very difficult to build housing in these areas. And that's really, I think, at the root of our housing crisis.
Max Podemski, his new book is A Paradise of Small Houses, The Evolution, De-evolution, and Potential Rebirth of Urban Housing. Max, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks so much. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on the California Sun Podcast. I hope you'll join us next week. I'm Jeff Shackman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.